Morning, Council. Ready to proceed?
Good morning, Chief Justice Steele, Justice Holland, Justice Ridgely. I'm Joseph Bernstein. I'm here representing Melvin Williams, who's the appellant in this case. I guess the maximum, the kind of honesty is the best policy here. And I didn't participate in either Mr. Williams' first trial or the second trial, but I was engaged to present this appeal. And in reviewing the record, and I suppose and this is just anecdotal, Mr. Williams' first trial ended in a hung jury, and he was tried again. And my experience is that sometimes what happens, and many times what happens, where the state gets a second chance to prosecute somebody, they kind of clean up their act. And if there were mistakes made in the first trial, they're usually corrected in the second trial. And when I reviewed the record in this case, it struck me that for a first-degree murder case, this was a very clean trial. There were almost no objections. And in reviewing the record, quite frankly, I was hard-pressed to find things that, if I had been the trial attorney, I would have objected to.
I think that was reflected in the fact that you've only cited one case on appeal. I give you high marks for your interest in judicial economy.
I can't say that.
But speaking, I say that in the context of your mentioning no objections, because that one case that you did cite, Burl, did have a motion for a judgment of acquittal. And in this case, not only were there not many objections, there was no motion for a judgment of acquittal.
That's
there?
Correct. And I think I acknowledged that in the brief.
Well, it looked in the brief where you were just talking about sufficiency of the evidence. But in the state's answering brief, they suggested the standard's really plain error because there was no motion for a judgment of acquittal.
I would agree with that. There was no motion for a judgment of acquittal. However, I think that the court always has to, in any criminal case, whether it's raised or not, whether it's raised in a trial court or not, decide whether the evidence was sufficient as a matter of law to support a conviction. So I raised that issue, even though it wasn't raised at trial, and I acknowledge that. And this is a case, unusually, where there were no objections to any evidence.
But still unappealed. We're focusing on a situation where the defense attorney, who was there for the presentation of the state's evidence, decided not to make a motion for a judgment of acquittal.
I don't know whether that was a deliberate decision.
No, I'm just making it an observation as a fact. That's our record.
That's correct.
And then there was no motion for a new trial based on the insufficiency of the evidence.
That's correct.
Okay.
And I would agree that the standard of review is plain error. However, I think that the court should always take cognizance of a claim, whether it was preserved at trial or not, that the evidence was not sufficient.
In the context of a motion for judgment of acquittal having been made and then reviewed, under ordinary review, and plain error for failure to make it, is there really a difference?
I don't believe there is.
So it can be made or not made? Is that your...
Well, I'm not suggesting that counsel should deliberately not make a motion for acquittal at the close of the state's case or renew a motion if there's a conviction. That should be done as... I would say almost as a matter of course.
Right. It'll save a lot of time
if there's some
for everybody
basis for
if the trial ends right there.
I'm sorry?
It will save a lot of time for everybody if the trial ends right there.
Well, it would. But obviously the trial judge did not have an occasion to pass on that motion, to weigh the evidence, to decide whether it should have been submitted to a jury.
Well, tell us about the insufficiency of this evidence.
I'm sorry?
Go ahead with your argument on the merits.
Well, this was a completely circumstantial case. There was certainly evidence that Melvin Williams had gotten the victim's car as what they call colloquially a bloop ride, take the car in exchange for drugs. It's apparent that the victim was addicted to crack cocaine. The house where the victim's body was found was generally known as a crack house that was frequented by any number of people in and out at all times of the day or night. There was evidence that illegal substances were being used in the house. The most, I guess, compelling, if you want to use that word, evidence against Melvin Williams was the fingerprint evidence, that there was a bottle of cleaner that was found in the basement with his prints on it. But there were also a number of other unknown prints on that same bottle.
What about the testimony by Fields that he overheard the defendant basically admit the crime?
Fields was a juvenile who told the police in an out-of-court statement that he overheard Melvin Williams saying he banked some guy over on Monroe Street.
He mentioned his cousin's basement, didn't he?
Yes. And at trial, Fields renounced that statement. Obviously, that's a question of credibility for the jury, whether Fields was telling the truth in his out-of-court statement or being truthful in his in-court statement. But again,
Where do we go with that when we talk about sufficiency of the evidence? You know, from the defense perspective, when we've talked about lesser-included offenses, if the defendant testifies in a manner that would support an instruction for a lesser-included offense, even if it's inconsistent with the physical layout, we've said, to the extent the jury found that testimony under oath credible, you get the lesser included offense. So in looking at the sufficiency of the evidence, when we introduced this credibility assessment and we added to the fingerprint evidence, why, as a matter of law, is it insufficient?
It's a tough question. Obviously, if the test for sufficiency of the evidence is, could a jury find the defendant guilty if they believed the state's version of the case, and that could a reasonable juror return a guilty verdict, I suppose that it's certainly possible that a reasonable juror could. The defendant in this case did not testify.
Which would explain why trial counsel didn't make a motion for a judgment of acquittal, wouldn't it?
It's certainly one plausible explanation, yes.
But is it the standard as you articulated it, the Jackson and Virginia standard on sufficiency of the evidence?
I believe it is, yeah. Is there enough evidence for a reasonable juror to return a conviction? I think that's the proper standard, and quite frankly, although this was a completely circumstantial case and there were pieces of evidence that could have pointed in other directions other than Melvin Williams, obviously this is probably going to be a case where there may be post-conviction proceedings involved about, you know, why wasn't this explored or why wasn't that explored? Obviously, that's not something that can be raised or considered in this direct appeal. obviously, as appellate counsel, I'm limited by what happened in the trial or what didn't happen in the trial. And this is one of those cases, and quite frankly, I was surprised in reading through the transcript how clean of a trial it was. There were no objections to anything. And I suppose you you have to work with what you have. And this is a case where, quite frankly, there wasn't much to work with.
Well, we appreciate your candid assessment.
You know, it's hard to say anything else. I think if I did, I'd be ducking under the table here. But unless the court has any other questions, I'll just save my rebuttal time to answer some things the state may bring up.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
May it please the court, Elizabeth McFarland on behalf of the state. Following my learned counsel's argument, I find I have not a whole lot to say today. The state would point out that it was definitely a plain error, and plain error is not the same as de novo review. Otherwise, as Justice Ridgely pointed out, it would be meaningless to make a distinction as to whether trial counsel needed to, in fact, move for a judgment of acquittal. Based on that, there must be some difference. And the difference is that in plain error, the error must be plain, obvious on its face, and as counsel has conceded, there is no obvious error on its face in this case. It was a circumstantial case. There were definitely gaps in the state's case. However, there was sufficient evidence presented that a rational juror could have found the defendant guilty beyond a reasonable doubt of all the crimes with which he was charged. The evidence pointed toward him, although the defense at trial was that the state had failed to pursue other leads. The state is not obligated to pursue every potential lead there may be. No one would be prosecuted if the state were held to that burden. There may always be one random piece of evidence that is inexplicable to anyone.
Or everyone would be prosecuted, which would be the more likely result.
Given the number of deputies we have, I don't think that would be possible, and the court would not be able to sustain that either. However, I think it's clear that given the testimony at trial, given the physical evidence at trial, that there was sufficient evidence here that the jury could consider the case, and they did. The court has no questions?
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I really don't have anything. The state said that I can feel comfortable rebutting, so I'm going to waive my rebuttal.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and recess.
Please rise.